I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Between 1950 and 2000, Philadelphia lost one quarter of its population, about 500,000 people. In recent years, the city has seen the population grow, fueled by immigrants, by boomers, and young people attracted to many things, including the relatively affordable housing, at least compared to other big cities. Neighborhoods that ring Center City Philadelphia have been transformed by a housing boom and development, often referred to as gentrification. And while new residents can bring investment and amenities to a community, it can also lead to displacement of older and less well-off homeowners and renters. Well, today on Radio Times, how to mitigate the negative effects of gentrification while encouraging economic growth, a big topic. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Ernie Young, former Philadelphia Daily News reporter. She covered real estate and economic development in Philadelphia for many years. And Ernie Young, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Jonathan Tannen, director of eConsult Solutions Incorporated. That's an economic policy consulting firm in Philadelphia. And Jonathan Tannen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Emily Dowdall, and she's Chief of Development and Policy Implementation for Policy Solutions, and that's at the Reinvestment Fund. And Emily Dowdall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, call in if you have any questions or comments or stories to tell about gentrification. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily, let me begin with you. What does gentrification mean, and is it a pejorative?
Well, there are a lot of different definitions of gentrification out there, and I think it often falls in that category of things where you know it when you see it. But I think essentially it's a change where people of one income, a neighborhood that's been characterized as moderate or low income or working class, begin seeing an influx of a different economic class of people, where we see people with higher incomes move in, and associated with that is higher housing costs, different types of businesses opening, and sort of a different types of changes in population.
Are there winners then and losers when it comes to gentrification?
Well, I think an important thing to keep in mind is that gentrification is not one uniform process. It plays out in very different types of neighborhoods at very different speeds and with different impacts. If it happens in a neighborhood where there's high home ownership, like in Passyunk Square, then longtime owners get an increase in their home equity and they can benefit. If it happens in neighborhoods like Graduate Hospital, where there were many renters, it's much harder for those longer-term residents to hang on and to benefit.
To you, Ernie Young, and this is based on the many years that you covered Philadelphia's real estate and economic development scene, how would you say the city has been transformed by gentrification?
It comes under the heading of be careful what you ask for. The city wanted to be a 24-hour city. It wanted to be vibrant, and it was in dire straits because we had lost so much population growth. So it set forth to make us more attractive to developers. And this is the result due to demographics of age and job creation. We have attracted a lot of millennials and baby boomers who have higher incomes than those people who live in around. And development followed them because the Neighborhood Transformation Initiative and the 10-year tax abatement
under Mayor Street
made this a very attractive environment in which to build.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Jonathan Tannen. And it's interesting to look at some of the neighborhoods that have been, quote unquote, gentrified. Mm-hmm. They tend to sort of ring Center City. Is that pretty typical of what we're talking about?
That is absolutely typical. That when you look at neighborhoods that are likely to gentrify, it does not occur evenly across a city. It occurs essentially next to already gentrified or already wealthy, predominantly white neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods will expand outwards from the central city. It often occurs in neighborhoods with large old housing stock, nice housing stock, with good transportation options and access to the city. It occurs very fine scale by these neighborhoods expanding block by block outwards as people try to move into the neighborhoods mm-hmm. that are already relatively wealthy. They can't afford that, so they move just on the other side of a boundary, and we see these regions expand.
We were talking about this before going on the air, sort of how a neighborhood then becomes attractive to the people that we've been talking about. And Emily, we were talking about Fishtown, and you know, years ago, and when in another occupation that I had, I did a lot of case management, knocking on people's doors in Fishtown when it was a really poor neighborhood. Why Fishtown? What happened that created the boom that we see in that neighborhood today?
Right. So we spoke about how, you know, as longtime Philadelphians, when you think about Fishtown and how we thought about it decades ago, it's incredibly surprising to think about all the changes that have happened there. But if you look from year to year, you know, it really does follow this pattern. You know, gentrification is not spontaneous combustion. It doesn't just happen out of nowhere. Old City first was attracting artists. And then those artists moved to Northern Liberties. Then those artists moved up to Fishtown. And so if you look over time, there's actually been a steady progression up from Center City and up towards Fishtown.
But led by what you were describing, Ernie Young, as this creative class.
The creative class. Northern Liberties had the kind of building, or I won't say housing stock, but building stock, old factories or warehouses that attracted young artists and other, and they lived there cheap. Then came the piazza.
The piazza, yes.
Or the idea, the concept. Before by the time the piazza was actually built, Northern Liberties around it had pretty much, as I said, filled in, gentrified as you want to. I hate to use that term. Gentrification to me is a displacement of a low to moderate income, lower income groups by people of higher incomes, whether they're sky blue people, mm-hmm. yellow polka dots.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter the color.
It doesn't matter. It's about money.
Money.
And yes, displacement occurs because renters, and these were in the, those young creative class people didn't have the money. So when the rents went up, And the buildings where they lived were being converted into luxury lofts. Does anybody build non-luxury housing anymore? they jumped across Girard Avenue to Fishtown and Kensington, which had huge, the same kind of, you know, industrial empty buildings and inexpensive row homes and lots of vacancy.
Yeah.
It had one of the higher concentrations of vacant lots and abandoned buildings in the city. And there it goes. I mean, as soon as Northern Liberties was filled up, the developers jumped across Girard. When some realtor told me that they wanted to dub the area just across north of Girard as Janogi. Because they didn't want the connotation of lower North Philadelphia.
Oh. Well, names matter, right? Right, Jonathan?
Names certainly matter. I will say that we should be very clear about how we use the word displacement. So this is going to get a little bit academic, but the research on displacement has a very surprising but often replicated finding, which concludes that in gentrifying neighborhoods, there does not appear to be displacement.
The idea that people are shoved out or pushed out.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to measure, obviously. But how we measure it is if you look at two neighborhoods at the beginning of a time period that appear similar in all ways, and one gentrifies and the other doesn't, the neighborhoods that are there at the beginning of the time period are just as likely to have moved out in the gentrifying neighborhood as in the non-gentrifying neighborhood. So there isn't an increased probability of households moving out in gentrifying neighborhoods. Now, really what's driving that is actually that households in low-income neighborhoods have very high probabilities of moving out to begin
with. There's a lot of flux.
There's a lot of flux. They're very unstable. So it's not really a happy story. Household instability is a problem for kids, is a problem for houses. But it does mean that in gentrifying neighborhoods, it does not households are not more likely to move out. They may be moving out for different reasons, but
End up perhaps with a more economically homogeneous neighborhood.
So
as a result of
the way the population then changes is that the houses that are moving out get replaced by a different set of people.
Right.
You get replaced by wealthier people. You get replaced by you know, in the case of Philadelphia, black households get replaced by white households. So it feels like the neighborhood's changing, even as the individual households may not be more likely to move out.
Emily, you want to add to that?
Yeah, just to build both on what Ernie and Jonathan have been saying, I think it's really useful to step back and expand the discussion from gentrification to neighborhood change, and also to involuntary displacement in general, right, especially in a city like Philadelphia. So when I worked on a study on gentrification for Pew, what we found was that gentrification was really happening, but in a really small, limited number of neighborhoods. And by far, the biggest type of change that was happening in Philadelphia was still some disinvestment and decline in other parts of the city. Involuntary displacement happens in other forms other than rising housing prices, right? So we've got a big evictions problem in Philadelphia. We've still got foreclosures. There are fewer of them than there were during the depths of the housing crisis, but we've still got them. And so I think when we're crafting policy solutions, we really have to think about that full spectrum of neighborhood change to really acknowledge the complexity of city neighborhoods and how they're always changing over time as kids are born, as people age, as people come and go for any number of reasons, and really think about the complexity of neighborhood change.
Ernie, you had mentioned developers, and clearly there are developers in Philadelphia, but I'm also thinking about gentrification where perhaps it is this creative class. They see a house in a block in a neighborhood and they say, oh, I can afford $500 a month. And then that begins the process. Do developers follow suit? Are they leaders or is it a mix?
Development, as we see it, is pretty much like water. It follows the path of least resistance. The reason, for example, Fishtown, Kensington were easier to develop than, say, going across on the west side of Broad and going up into North Philadelphia. There was more resistance from the community
from
level.
From neighborhoods.
Going south was easier than going north, which is why the area going south of South and Washington and below between the Queen Village, those areas went first because they were easier. And there was no real resistance from the community. They realized real estate values go up. And renters, I'm not unsympathetic because I know this is dire, but renters are always at the mercy of the marketplace.
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter whether that marketplace is booming or whether it's sinking. They're at the mercy of it. Homeowners have more of a cushion. We had no one remembers, and we still have a significant, how the sheer size of the vacancy in Philadelphia and the housing stock that is built, almost more than half of it built before 1940. That housing was deteriorating rapidly. These people would have been displaced from those neighborhoods and moved more than likely had we not had the development boom. Just the sheer collapse and loss of housing stock would have caused the same thing. They would have had to move because the housing that they were living in was untenable and unstable.
I hear you. Much more to talk about after this very short break. That's Ernie Young. Also with us, Jonathan Tannen, Emily Dowdall. We are talking about gentrification, urban development, economic growth in the city of Philadelphia. I see some comments here. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499 and tell us about your neighborhood. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Emily Dowdall. She's Chief of Development and Policy Implementation for Policy Solutions. That's at the Reinvestment Fund here in Philadelphia. Jonathan Tannen, Director of eConsult Solutions. That's an economic policy consulting firm also in Philadelphia. And Ernie Young, former Philadelphia Daily News reporter, and she covered real estate and economic development for the paper for many years. And we're talking about all of that with our guests and with you. To join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We did get a statement from the Kenney administration in regards to affordable housing for our broadcast. Unfortunately, I can't read an entire paragraph. We just took the very last sentence. Our goal is to make every neighborhood in Philadelphia a neighborhood that people choose to live in. And we will post the whole statement on our Facebook page so people can read that and think about what all of that means. And I guess I guess the goal is to try to figure out, Emily, how to create neighborhoods that people all want to live in. And I guess the question is, can we have diverse neighborhoods, whether racially or economically, where people can coexist?
Yeah, I think making gentrification work for everyone is sort of a holy grail of urban policy, right? But a recent study that came out from Brookings showed that not many cities have actually succeeded in sort of achieving this balanced growth that benefits multiple people. But there are a lot of tools available to policymakers, to other stakeholders, to community groups in order to try and build those, you know, vibrant mixed income neighborhoods that many of us would really like to see. And I think about it as sort of four different buckets of policies. Mm-hmm. There's protecting places, which is to say, in some way preserving existing affordable units, either homeownership or rental. Then there's protecting people, keeping longtime owners in their place, longtime renters in their place of residence. Then there's using new development to grow new revenue, mm-hmm. and that revenue can be used for any variety of things to support low and moderate income households. And then finally, there's promoting and preserving mixed income neighborhoods. And because gentrification plays out so differently in different places, you need to have a full suite of tools available to you in order to promote these things.
And does such a place exist in Philadelphia that meets all those tools?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, there's the Kennedy administration is working hard on this, and there's a lot of different community groups working hard on this, civic associations, communities of faith. And there are certainly neighborhoods, I think, that are still economically diverse, parts of West Philadelphia, parts of Northwest Philadelphia, parts of the Northeast. It's much more difficult the closer you are to Center City, but I think that bringing this full set of tools together, we can maintain some of those neighborhoods.
Let me turn to you, Jonathan, and let's talk a little bit about Cedar Park. I know it's a play. This is West Philadelphia. We should probably define where it is. But you have looked at a number of neighborhoods, but including this one.
So Cedar Park, the park after which it's named, is on Baltimore Avenue at 49th Street. Between 49th and 50th in West Philadelphia. And that's really at a boundary of where gentrification has occurred. That in 2000, that neighborhood was predominantly Black. In my research, I mostly use race because that's what we have down at the fine scale. Sadly, in Philadelphia, race is so heavily tied to income that you really can't separate gentrification from race. But Cedar Park was predominantly Black in 2000. The boundary of University City, of university-affiliated households, really expanded out past Cedar Park, such that these days the census tract surrounding Cedar Park is now 50% white and only 33% Black. So that's an example of how along the boundaries where gentrification is occurring, mm-hmm. even as the city as a whole isn't gentrifying very sharply, even as individual neighborhoods, when you zoom out at sort of a tract scale, may not look like they're gentrifying very sharply. There are individual blocks right along the boundary switch discreetly over a period of 10 years.
In fact, I was reading specifically about this particular neighborhood that there are blocks where largely African-Americans live, and then the next block is largely white people and then African-Americans. Is that what we're seeing?
Absolutely. I grew up in Cedar Park at 47th and Windsor, and even in the 90s, that was largely true, that when you zoom in at an individual block, tracks that seem to be fairly diverse at a block level can be entirely segregated. So my block that I grew up on, I'm white, and my block was probably 18 white households and two Black households. Mm-hmm. So even in a predominantly Black neighborhood, I lived on an almost entirely white block.
So what does that tell us, Ernie?
It tells us a lot about home ownership among African Americans. They tend to cling to place. We are not as mobile as culture. And I don't make sweeping statements, but from my experience, there's a tendency among moderate to low income households to cling to place. They don't move every 7 years. Mom dad left the house, the kids stayed in the house, it goes back. They don't think about moving up necessarily. And when they do, unfortunately, those who do, it's to the suburbs. We are still following, African middle class and upper middle class Americans are still following that old pattern of moving up, moving out. Where on the other hand, whites are moving back into the cities and creating that pressure. We have a significant black middle class in the city.
Yep.
But they aren't living in the city. They are living in the surrounding suburban ring. I have tried to convince professional African Americans to buy in those in the new housing that's going up in Francisville and they are not interested. They are not pioneers. I basically call creative class. Whether they were, the last generation of this, essentially, they are fearless. They see themselves as agents of change.
And cities need these people.
Right. They see themselves, if it may not look good now, but, give us 10 years, it will. They gamble. African Americans don't gamble.
Hmm.
Not that way. And that's the difference in wealth. We don't reap that benefit.
Let me pick up on a couple of things, Emily, that Ernie just said, and something I was reading. One third of Philadelphian homeowners make $35,000 a year. So clearly, these are people with homes but relatively low incomes. I was also reading about something called tangled titles.
Oh, yeah.
People thinking that they live in a house. Maybe it was their mom's or their grandmom's. It gets handed down over the generations. Someone comes and says, well, where's the deed to the house? And there is none. What's at stake here?
Right. So Philadelphia has a very long tradition of low income home ownership that makes it distinct from other cities in a lot of ways. And also a tradition of people staying in the same neighborhood for generations. And so families who had modest means were able to pass down these homes from grandmother, et cetera, as you're saying, down through the generations, which in some ways has made those families more resilient and positions them potentially to stay on in neighborhoods as they change, as amenities increase. But because of that same sort of informality, we run into this problem of tangled titles. And that can be a really big threat to this tradition of intergenerational homeownership and presence in a community over time. And so a lot of it has to do with education, getting out there and educating people about what happens when you inherit a house and how you actually need to do official paperwork.
Could you lose your home because of a tangled title?
There have been instances of people losing their homes. And then it also can bring up problems when people try to access programs such as the longtime owner occupant program that the city introduced along with the property tax reform, where you were eligible for a property tax freeze, essentially, if you had lived in your home for 10 years. And many people have lived in their home for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and their name isn't anywhere on the deed. Oh. So people had trouble sort of accessing those programs. So this is a really big challenge.
And this is a city, Jonathan, of row homes, which is attractive. I mean, these are places where you can live. You don't have a million windows where you can lose all the heat from the winter. Has that made gentrification or even development attractive in the city because of the number of row homes?
Absolutely. Philadelphia is full of the housing stock that is notorious for attracting younger, wealthier people, young urbanists who are now moving to the city. It absolutely makes Philadelphia an appealing place to move. Now, even with that being said, I think it's also important to say that gentrification is not the dominant story of Philadelphia over the last decade. That gentrification feels very pertinent because it's so sharp where it does occur. Probably also it's where most of the journalists and academics live.
So it's
the story that gets told. But overall, between 2000 and 2010, Philadelphia became less white, became much more Hispanic, a little bit more Asian, and the black population basically had held firm. And even in the 5 years since 2010, or in between 2010 and 2015, Philadelphia again became less white. So
And more racially diverse than?
More racially diverse. Mostly that's been driven by a large increase in the Hispanic population. Mm-hmm. That has really been fueling Philadelphia's population boom.
Let me read some comments here, and we get some callers in on the conversation. A tweet from Alex Pugh did an excellent piece which showed more neighborhoods are endangered to tip into disinvestment than gentrification. Did you write that, Emily?
I did write that.
Do you want to expand on that at all?
Sure, yeah. So what we found was that it was something like 15 census tracts. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, qualified as gentrifying according to our definition, which was income-based. Right. But even if you look at housing price definition, you end up with a sort of similar core area where there's been these radical changes in terms of shifting upmarket. Much more common in Philadelphia is the continued decline of our outlying neighborhoods. And
outlying within the city?
Within the city. So okay. Within city limits. So, you know, Winfield, Overbrook, a lot of places that were actually traditionally homes to the black middle class. And I think, you know, part of that is the story of people being able to move to the suburbs in ways that they weren't before. And, you know, the other dynamics that have still gone on where we're now seeing growth in eds and meds jobs in West Philadelphia and in Center City, but those other neighborhoods, their job bases have sort of still dwindled, right? So it's important to keep that in mind.
Also a tweet from Megan, why aren't we using the hashtag gentrification RE Northern Liberties? The displacement of lower income folks is exactly what happened. Taking issue, I think, with you, perhaps, Jonathan, a little bit. About this whole issue of displacement.
Yeah. So it's a surprising finding, and I think sociologists are still trying to figure out what the real story is. Mm-hmm. The dominant effect seems to be that many of the households in poor neighborhoods would have ended up moving anyway. So in a neighborhood that looks like Northern Liberties,
it looks like gentrification.
It is gentrification. Housing prices are going up. But it turns out that households that were initially there were not more likely to have left. There's a recent Philadelphia Fed study in Philadelphia using great data looking at individual households and tracking them over time that showed that in Philadelphia over the last 20 years in gentrifying neighborhoods, households were not more likely to move out in gentrifying neighborhoods. It feels wrong because we see such sharp population changes.
Sure. Let me throw a tweet at you, Arne, if you don't mind. This is a tweet from Historic Tekoni, and that's a neighborhood in Philadelphia. They say historic neighborhoods offer the best opportunity for mixed incomes, higher variability of housing stock and types. Go ahead.
Just before I retired from the Daily News, I went to a homeowners meeting in Northern Liberties, and a bunch of Israeli developers were at that point who owned the Divine Lorraine were talking about the development that they were going to do. And there was a woman who showed up, and she owned a house in Northern Liberties. She was upset because her property taxes were going to go up. Young African-American woman, I say young, she was in her 40s. Had been a longtime resident, and she was outraged that her property taxes were going up. And she didn't care if she had to live with blight. She didn't want to pay higher property taxes. And I took her to one side and I said, honey, this is not your problem. You now have a house that is worth significantly more than what you paid for it. You have two choices. If you do not like what's going on in the neighborhood around you, sell the house, take the money, and run. Find some place where you feel comfortable. You also have the option, if you have problems paying your property taxes, your house is paid off, take out an equity loan, pay your taxes, stay in place. And she looked at me as if I had two heads. It had never occurred to her to do that she had that option, that the increased property taxes meant increased cash for her. She just couldn't see that.
Yeah, that's such an excellent story. Let me get Herman, who lives in Mantua, also a section in West Philadelphia, to join our conversation. Herman, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, and good morning.
Morning.
I'm a longtime resident of Mantua, about 40-some years. I'm a real estate developer. I've done like $16 million in construction, low-income housing. And I really see the issues quite differently. One, the way I hear this being discussed really talks about the issue from the point of it's being a created problem. And I'll give you an example. Mantua, for almost 40 years prior to the new mortgages my organization brought in to it, that community, had not seen a new mortgage. Mm-hmm. You could have a property that is now worth $300,000. That was in the same condition 30 years ago, and you couldn't get a $15,000 home improvement loan. So disinvestment, lack of employment through local industry and organizations like Drexel, who's had zero employment impact on this community over the last 30 years. Those are, the lack of fire insurance, being able to get fire insurance, the redlining.
Sure.
These communities have been set up to become disinvested.
Well, you know what, Herman, let me take your point. And I realize you probably have more to say. We're almost up in a break here, but I'm not sure we're discussing this as if it's a problem. I mean, I think cities, neighborhoods are in flux. We want to try to create a situation where there aren't winners and losers. And obviously developers very quickly, Jonathan, I mean, developers play a role in all of this.
So developers absolutely play a role in this. It looks like mostly where the development comes in is after the initial stage of gentrification. So the population has started to change, and that's when the developers come in and start constructing and really increase the property values.
And that is Jonathan Tannen from eConsult Solutions. Also with us, Ernie Young, former Philadelphia Daily News reporter who covered real estate and economic development, and Emily Dowdall from the Reinvestment Fund. We are talking about urban renewal, development, gentrification, whatever you call it. And you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The conversation off the air is as interesting as the one on the air. We're talking about how to make gentrification work for everyone. And you can send us a comment, radiotimes at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily, let me pick up on something Herman said. He used the word redlining. There's a whole difficult history associated with redlining. Is that still a problem today, or are we still dealing with the after effects of that?
In some ways, we are still dealing with the after effects of redlining in a few different ways. And I think it's also just interesting to think about how some people have a really different sort of time frame when they think about gentrification neighborhood change than other people. And this came up a lot as I researched this. A lot of people really do see that line going back from urban renewal on through what's happening today. And you often hear this analogy drawn to Native Americans, and people say, we feel like we're Native Americans who have been moved around from one neighborhood to another. Oh, now they found oil under our neighborhood, right? There's this new value here. We're getting moved again. And that's really powerful, right? It's really powerful. And I think redlining sort of has had effects in a few ways. One, it prevented African Americans from accumulating wealth through owning homes by making it hard for them to get mortgages and hard for them to invest in neighborhoods and keeping values in those neighborhoods artificially low. And it also created lots of vacancy and disinvestment over time, which then set up the stage for investors to come in later and redevelop those areas. And so many of the areas that gentrified in the 2000s had seen urban renewal activity back in the 60s or 70s. And, it took 30 to 40 years for those plans to come to fruition in a way.
Are we still feeling the after effects of the recession of 08 that certainly hit the housing market so hard? I mean, people who were underwater, have we dug out from that? Do we know?
Not in some neighborhoods. In lower income neighborhoods and in areas like lower Northeast, which were de facto senior citizens' homes because most of the homeowners were over the age of 65 and had household incomes of $20,000 or less. So when the foreclosure wave came, these people had taken out equity loans, second mortgages, refis, and the foreclosure hit them hard.
Yeah.
And you had homeowners who in North Philadelphia, for example, who's managed to access some capital through city mortgage programs, and they were caught flat-footed. They lost jobs. You know, and they had almost no wiggle room. If the hot water heater goes, it's gone.
In trouble.
You're in trouble. So yeah, they're still they can't bounce back from that. They lost a lot. I mean, they were wiped out wealth wise, net worth. They were thrown into the rental market. Home ownership, and this is a personal view of mine, is not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a certain amount of income stability to be able to afford a house that you own, because you can't call the landlord or the super to fix something. That's up to you. And if you don't have the wherewithal to fix it, what you have is not an asset, but a giant stone around your neck.
No question about it. Did you want to add to what we were talking about, Jonathan?
Yeah. so just thinking about recovery since the recession, Philadelphia for a long time was much slower than other large cities to recover from the recession. Job growth was lagged other large cities. Housing prices stayed flat for years. That being said, it looks like the last 2 years, Philadelphia has rebounded and exceeded other cities. So we have.
Is that in part because it's more affordable than other cities? I mean,
yeah. So certainly.
Certainly compared to New York, it's no question.
Absolutely. It's more affordable. Philadelphia has a number of jobs in the so-called eds and meds in universities and in hospitals, which are driving the economy these days. So Philadelphia could be well positioned into the future. And after years of very slow housing price growth, we have a Philadelphia Housing Index in which houses have skyrocketed in the last 2 years. Housing prices have recovered to 2008 levels and actually in April surpassed 2008 levels in Philadelphia.
So it took about 8 years or so to come back.
It took 8 years, and six of those years there was essentially no rebound.
Interesting. Let me get Steve from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm listening. I'm wondering how anecdotal to get with you about this, but I think I want to just boil it down to the basics, and that is the relationship. What is the relationship between increased home equity in a developing area and the ability of homeowners to then leverage for home equity loans that would allow them to perhaps maintain their property at a right level that they hadn't been under pressure to do when everything around them was, more or less dilapidated.
Well, Steve, that's sort of picking up on what Ernie was talking about a little bit, but perhaps I can toss this to you, Emily, about just, you know, if the goal is to create some kind of stability for people and for neighborhoods, how to keep people in their homes, especially when there's added value.
Sure. And the caller brings up a really good point because a lot of times older folks who live on fixed incomes have trouble not just upgrading their homes to make it fit in with a neighborhood that's getting a little fancier, but to perform basic repairs, pay for a new heater, for a new roof, things like that. And it can be hard for them to get home equity loans. And so as values rise, it can be easier to access those resources. However, longtime homeowners need to be really careful because that can open them up to risk if, in fact, these loans are predatory in nature, which we know happens in gentrifying neighborhoods. We know people experience lots of pressure from people trying to sell them dubious products. We know with reverse mortgages, which are something that are available to older homeowners to access the equity in their home, we've seen in some areas worryingly high levels of foreclosures associated with those reverse mortgages. So imagine you're a homeowner who's owned your home, you own it outright, and then you take out this loan and you're at risk of foreclosure. So there's a risk to manage with that strategy as well.
I don't want to let the hour go by without talking about relationships, which is something we talked about before going on the air. Philadelphia is a city of neighborhoods with distinct characteristics, I would say, also distinct names as well. But when moving into a neighborhood, Jonathan, and what's important in terms of creating an environment, a community environment, if not relationships?
So,
it's like saying hi in the morning, right?
Absolutely. So relationships matter. Neighborhood institutions really matter. They're very appealing. You know, as someone who lives in a neighborhood, you love the neighborhood institutions, but also interacting with, but also in attracting new residents to the neighborhood, and cultivating those and being purposeful about cultivating those is really important for the city, for both the current residents and potential future residents. It can be surprising how quickly so-called neighborhood institutions change. So I still remember when the first cafe showed up along Baltimore Avenue in West Philly. 15 years ago, it blew my mind. I ran home, grabbed a camera, and took a picture because it felt so weird to see a cafe in the neighborhood. And now people who have moved in since think of that as a touchstone for the neighborhood. Same thing with the yoga studio that opened up 5 years later.
And still there.
Still there, right above the new pet shop. so the neighborhood has greatly changed. I think it's important to cultivate institutions and to be careful about choosing the types of institutions that will help to preserve integration, to end segregation. That we can't just let the gentrifiers pick the institutions that get preserved. We need, in addition to the yoga studio, we need the stores that have been there for a little bit longer.
Oh, and make sure that they're going to remain. Let me get Priscilla from Brewery Town to join us, another neighborhood in Philadelphia. Priscilla, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I live on the cusp of Fairmont and Brewery Town, and I bought 22 years ago, and the neighborhood was so much different, even up until, I'd say, even 8 years ago. And now it feels like unchecked development. My house got reassessed 5 times its value, and my income didn't get reassessed 5 times its value. And even though I am in the LUP program and I had the home exemption of $35,000, it still was reassessed 3 times its value. That's how the LUP program works, from what your original value was. And I am not trying to leave. I invested in this community when it was very unpopular and everyone told me don't. But I was a transplant New Yorker, and I saw the vision, the proximity to everything. And it's a real struggle now to remain here. And the other issue is the tax exemption, to see so many people coming in. And I guess this is a personal aspect. I've worked so hard for the community in various ways. And then you have just an influx of people, and it looks like it's going to be for the next few years because it's unbelievable, the building. It's very alienating. It's changing rapidly, even places that are going in. I know people are upset about a new pizza place that moved in at 29th and Girard. And the slice of pizza is like very expensive. It seems very targeted to definitely demographics.
Sure. You know what, Priscilla, I really appreciate the phone call because I think you raised some very important points. I'm just looking at the clock and I want to make sure we do justice to some of the things that you raised. And let me see what Ernie Young has to say. I mean, here's someone, she was one of those early, the pioneers that you talked about. She saw a neighborhood that she wanted to live in. She has invested, sounds like, a lot of her time and energy to make it what it is. And now she feels like perhaps I can't afford to stay there.
What were you working for is my question. Most people who real estate isn't a home, is an investment. If you want shelter, you rent. If you invest in real estate, you want a return on your investment. If your house does not appreciate in value, then you've wasted your money. You could have rented and had more mobility. Now, you've got a piggy bank. It's got more money in it. Sentiment aside, and I'm not downplaying that, people mm-hmm. have real loyalty to place. But that was your goal. That's your retirement money. That's your, if you get sick and you need to pull money out of your house, that house is an investment vehicle.
But it's also to see the neighbor. Right, I mean, I hear her saying it's
right. I know that, but that sentiment, that doesn't have anything to do with the real economy. Neighborhoods do not are like sharks. They have to keep moving. They either move forward or they stop. They die. There is no decline. Mm. There is no like stability where we're just going to have the status quo and nothing's going to change. Get to know your new neighbors. They're not barbarians who came across the gate. I mean, who came across the mountains to invade your territory. They're not your enemy. They're your new neighbors.
Oh, interesting. Anything you want to add to that, Jonathan?
I will add, you know, as we approach the end of the hour, while gentrification does not appear to have quite all of the harms that that I think we ascribe before we look at them, I do think that Philadelphia, it does mean that Philadelphia is in a very special case, a once-in-a-lifetime situation where Philadelphia is one of the most highly segregated cities in the country. We experience hyper-segregation. We have pockets of persistent concentrated poverty. We now have a number of low-income neighborhoods that could attract higher-income, predominantly white populations. It's important that we don't just let that transition happen wholesale and go from 100% black to 100% white. If we are strategic and careful about preserving the integrated halfway step, which has been very hard for cities to achieve, we could eliminate or turn down our city segregation, which has been ailing us ever since redlining.
Emily, I'm giving you the last word. Go ahead.
Great. So I think that it does get back to relationships, both touching on sort of segregation and what do you do about these neighborhoods. And that's where we have to recognize the limits of policy. I think there's a lot of great policy tools that Philadelphia hasn't necessarily used to their full capacity yet. But I think a lot of the discomfort around gentrification has to do with cultural change. And that's really where you need to bring in neighborhood civic associations, where you need to bring in local nonprofits, houses of worship. And it can really help to organize people around issues that are cross-cutting. So not something that only the new folks are interested in, but maybe a long-time problem that people can really come around and solve together. And I think that can help people sort of build that sense of community and try and hang in there together.
And is there a place where you think that is happening? And sometimes it's coalescing around schools, you know, getting a school that can educate all children.
Sure. There's a really good example in South Philadelphia at the Andrew Jackson Elementary School where it's in a gentrifying neighborhood. So a lot more people are sort of interested in sending their kids there. They're almost now at capacity where they've been way below capacity for a long time. But the people who were new to sort of organizing efforts looked at themselves and said, we look a little bit different. We have a different education level than the longtime students at this school. But let's not just talk about, say, a new Latin class that we think is going to get our kid into college, but let's get new air conditioners for the third floor where the older grades are. And this is an old building. And that was something that the entire community could get behind, was getting air conditioning into the school.
So interesting. I mean, talk about something really practical that benefits everybody. Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ernie Young, former Philadelphia Daily News reporter. She covered real estate and economic development. Thanks for coming in and joining us on Radio Times. Also with us, Jonathan Tannen, director of eConsult Solutions Incorporated. That's an economic policy consulting firm. Jonathan Tannen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Emily Dowdall, chief of development and policy implementation for Policy Solutions. That's at the Reinvestment Fund. And Emily, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.